This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
So Christmas came early for City fans this week, it seems. A soft penalty and a gift of a red card in the game against Wolves was enough to keep Pep Guardiola's side at the top of the table before Leeds came to the Etihad and played like they've been on the sherry for weeks already. Welcome to this week's Blue Moon Podcast, and on today's show we'll be reflecting over the last two games and the contrasting performances. Another question to consider is how much the return of fans has changed how City control games. Guardiola's spoken about it this week, and we've got Sam Roscoe on the case to investigate. We'll be looking ahead to the game with Newcastle, and we've saved some time to look back on Sergio Aguero's time with City as well. Following the news, he's been forced to retire on health grounds. I'm David Mooney. I'm bringing the festive cheer this week. I've got two City fans, Howard Hocking.
Hello.
And One Football's Dan Burke.
Hello. Not sure about the festive cheer, but I'm here. So, you
know. I was going to say, have I got the two most dour City fans on for the one where I've said festive cheer, even though it's not the one before Christmas?
How dare you?
Well, yes,
it has a two question. Yes,
yeah. I was going to say, Howard. Sure, like you, if anyone, that's your brand, isn't it? That's what you've built.
It is. Yeah, it's made me a millionaire. So.
Right. Let's start. I mean, let's start working backwards for this week, because I think we kind of have to begin with the end and that kind of Leeds nonsense that happened on Tuesday night. Howard, in all honesty, could that game have gone any better?
In all honesty, no, it could not. No, absolutely perfect. I was quite worried about this game as well. I know City only took a point off them last season. That's a long, long time ago. A lot's changed since then. And I felt that after the Wolves game, which of course discussed, that I didn't know in this, the carnage that is December fixture list, I don't know if they brought a lot of energy to this game. They could be a very troublesome side indeed, even though they had, looking at the lineup, you think, well, we should beat them easily with the players they had out. And really, within 3 minutes, I think it was, or certainly within 10 minutes, it was quite clear that City were on it. Leeds had played into our hands, and everything just went perfectly. The only way it could have gone better if we'd hit double figures, which we could have done.
Yeah.
But we've got to take players off as well. We've got to rest key players, take them off. Our goal difference has been, you know, we've pretty much caught up Chelsea and Liverpool, because normally we have the best goal difference in a division during the league season. Yeah, we've got work to do there, and it could be crucial in a close title race. So everything just went perfectly. Players we wanted to score, most of all, scored. Yeah, it was just absolutely a brilliant, brilliant night. And I really wasn't expecting it to be that enjoyable.
Yeah, I've just looked up the goal difference. City plus 31, Liverpool plus 33, and Chelsea plus 27. City are now ahead of Chelsea on goals scored. Five behind Liverpool on goals scored. And you think, Dan, a few weeks ago, we were talking about, you know, the City team, it doesn't concede a lot, fair play to it, but it hasn't been scoring like it has in previous years. Now, one game doesn't change that, but like it does in terms of the table. And when it comes to the end of the season rankings, if you've scored seven, if your goal difference is, you know, seven goals in one game or one goal in seven games, it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, I mean, we're competing with a Liverpool team who look like they're going to score every week, basically, don't they? So we have to keep the goals flowing, and it's nice to see them coming now. Yeah, you can't argue with 7-0, really, can you? It was a really emphatic display from City. A lot of players who perhaps haven't been in the greatest form this season. You know, Kevin De Bruyne is the obvious example, really coming to the fore and playing really well. And to a man, everyone on the pitch was brilliant, I thought. You know, Rodri was outstanding, as he has been a lot of the time. In fact, probably the sort of the most disappointing is probably the wrong word, but Bernardo Silva really didn't have to do a lot. He missed that chance early doors, didn't he?
And, yeah, he was crap, wasn't he?
Yeah, it's probably his worst game of the season, and he was still pretty good. And then he came off and got his rest, and yeah, everything went to plan. I mean, a lot of people were looking at the team selection before the game, weren't they, and sort of worrying about how it was going to look. Had Guardiola sort of lost his mind a little bit? And it turned out it was quite simple, really, wasn't it? John Stones played right back. He played very well there. We didn't need a right back in this game who was going to get forward in the way that Kyle Walker often does. I thought he dealt with Jack Harrison and Julia Firpo really well down Leeds' left-hand side, and it just created a foundation for our attacking players to go and do the thing. And it was such an entertaining, enjoyable game to watch. I loved every second of it.
Yeah, Dan, I was trying to think, when was the last time that a team came to the Etihad and basically went, yeah, you just have the middle of the pitch? I honestly don't remember that happening.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? I mean, I understand that Bielsa is a really good coach. I think he has done a really good job with Leeds to get them into the Premier League. I was a little bit confused as well about why people were a little bit worried about this game, because I've watched Leeds a few times this season and I've been pretty underwhelmed by them. I don't think they're the same team that they were last season. And for them to come and, you know, without Calvin Phillips and to just open up that space, it seemed ridiculously naive for a coach with Bielsa's pedigree and experience. And we sort of made hay while the sun shone, didn't we? Rodri was bursting into those positions like a prime Yaya Toure, and it was a bit lambs to the slaughter, weren't they, Leeds, really?
I think the fact they almost got a point at Chelsea might have put a bit of doubt into their mind, and the possible theory that they were coming back into some sort of form. They've looked a bit better previous weeks, but yeah, all that was completely irrelevant when it came to it. So
yeah, I'd never seen that. It was the number of the players, Howard, that just carried the ball into the middle. I've never seen it happen where Diaz did it, where Laporte did it, where Stones did it, where Rodri did it, where Gundogan did it. Like the number of players that sometimes teams just go, okay, that player is not the best on the ball, so we'll let them have it and let them carry it. Whereas Leeds just went, we'll let any City player who has the ball run into the middle.
It's strange. I think I think it dawned on the players after 10 minutes. Well, you know what? I can just carry this ball and keep carrying it. And that suggests that, they must be playing dead and have 10 players must be keeping all their players in the penalty area, you know, which had been a problem before. But they weren't doing that either. There was still, after they carried it forward, tons of space. There's just space everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, Leeds helped City, but I still don't think there's very few, if any, teams on the planet that would have taken such great advantage of the opportunities Leeds gave them as City did on Tuesday evening.
Yeah. Let's talk about some individual players because one of you, this shows how much I listen to the guests when they're on the show, because I can't remember which one of you said it already, and we've been going less than 10 minutes, but somebody mentioned Kevin De Bruyne back in form. I think it might have been you, Dan. He scored himself a brace, two like fantastic goals. I'm loath to say that he's put his injury and his bout of COVID behind him for this season, but the evidence was certainly very encouraging, wasn't it?
Yeah, he looks very sharp. He looks like he's back to his best. And I think with him, like a lot of players, he obviously got that injury in the Champions League finally. He went to the Euros, had those injections that sort of backfired on him and went wrong and made him feel worse. And he's taken a long time to recover from that. He was approaching a bit of form before he got COVID. I think he played pretty well against United at Old Trafford. Then he gets COVID, and then that knocks him back again. So it's been a very difficult season for him so far. I don't think I always thought that he was going to kind of get back to his best eventually. I don't think it was a sort of terminal problem for him. He is 30 now. You know, he is sort of getting to that stage of his career where he's either hitting his peak or he's past his peak, and we're probably never going to see a consistent Kevin De Bruyne like we've seen in the past again, really. But I think, yeah, he's an outstanding player, and he showed in this game what he's capable of again. And that goal was just brilliant, wasn't it? Just when he hits the ball like that, there's not an awful lot anyone can do about it.
Yeah, I was going to say, Howard, there's something nice, isn't there, when De Bruyne just decides to hit it really hard.
Yeah.
like
I read somewhere it's the second hardest goal. Second, 70 kilometres an hour or something. It's the second fastest, hardest hit goal of the season in the Premier League. I don't know if that's true. But, well, it sounds pretty true, to be honest, because when I saw it live, I thought, oh, that's top corner. Wow, absolute, unstoppable. It wasn't in the top corner, and yet the keeper still had no chance whatsoever of saving that shot. It was such power it was hit with. And, yeah, it's just, there's two brilliant Kevin De Bruyne sights that I've missed. Him hitting a shot like that and him just counter-attacking Kevin De Bruyne, where obviously the impossible passes are probably the third thing.
Yeah.
But the second thing is just him bursting past the player and counter-attacking and just, bursting up the pitch with the ball. It's just a joy to see him doing that repeatedly again in a match.
Yeah, let's not get too greedy with all three things at once, shall we? It was we got two of them and 7-0. So let's not get too greedy. The other one, Howard, was Jack Grealish, who it was about 3 or 4 minutes in where it started to dawn on me that this could be the game that he needs, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think, well, obviously opinions are split on Jack Grealish very much, I think, amongst the City fan base. I think he's doing fine. But eventually, well, I expect him to improve. I expect him under in a Pep side to be better second season than first season. And he has to add, it's just the way of it, of being an attacking player at City, you have to add stats to your game. You do have to add them. You have to add assists. You have to add goals. Now, if Jack Grealish sets up someone who misses an open goal, it's not his fault. But obviously there's improvements to come. And to get a goal, I think, is just massive for him. For his confidence, I don't think he's low on confidence, but I felt Wolves was, you know, the miss against Wolves will have hit him, I think. It's got to get into your head. He's coming to the best teams in the world on a huge transfer fee. You can't just push aside stuff like that. It was a perfect game for him. He might have waned slightly later in the game, but he was involved in the build-up to both the fourth and fifth goals as well, I think, earlier in the second half. And yeah, it's just, again, just an excellent game for him, and just hope he takes it on from here. And yeah, adds more goals, a few assists, it'll do him a world of good. But I'm not concerned about him whatsoever. He does have improvements to make. He has to go up different levels, but we have to be patient with him as well.
Yeah, Dan, if you'd got his shirt at the end of the game, would you have smelt it as well?
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. I'd still be smelling it now.
Yeah, yeah. It was the number of times where, like, he was another one, wasn't he, Dan, where he was carrying it really well. The number of times where he found himself on the touchline and either able to go around the outside or able to drive in towards the box, he'd start to get closed down, but then a little shimmy and he'd find a little bit of space again. And, he was starting to find those passes as well.
Yeah, he looks to me like someone who is aware or was aware that there was a bit of impatience growing among the fan base with him. I don't know if that transmits in the stadium or during matches, but that's certainly sort of the case on social media at the moment. I'm seeing a few sort of people saying, "Wow, why did we sign him? You know, 100 million for this is, you know, we should be doing so much better." I thought it was quite telling that Guardiola bigged him up quite a bit in the pre-match press conference, and I don't know how much attention players pay to that kind of stuff, but if Grealish had heard those comments, maybe that's given him a big boost. And yeah, he looks like someone who's kind of determined to prove himself in this game in particular. And yeah, like Howard said, there's no need to worry about Jack Grealish. We've got a great team. All right, we spent 100 million on him. Maybe we didn't need to spend that amount of money. Maybe we didn't need him in the summer necessarily, but I'm so confident that he's going to be a good player for us in future, a great player in fact. And it's just going to take a little bit of time. You know, there is a pattern of players taking time to find their feet in Guardiola's teams. And as Guardiola said, he's doing all the right things. He's doing everything right. It's just not quite coming off for him at times. And hopefully this will kickstart his season a little bit more. And we'll start seeing a few more goals from him now.
Yeah, I reckon if you go back a couple of years, we're probably having these same discussions about Riyad Mahrez, you know. He was another one again against Leeds. He looked really in the mood for it. It was kind of a little bit unfortunate that his goal was deflected, because that's something that people can detract from his performance. That, well, he only scored because it deflected. But there was a number of opportunities where I thought he was quite unlucky not to have had his second, and I thought he looked really in the mood for it as well.
Yeah, there was a point during the second half where he kept checking in onto his left foot as he does and whipping balls into the box. I was kind of thinking, do Leeds want to try and stop this maybe? But I don't think you no. can really. When he wants to do it, you can't do anything about it. He's such a classy player. And yeah, he's a perfect example of someone who took a little bit of time to settle, and now he's settled. He's you know, one of our best players, really. I think his contribution goes under the radar a little bit still. And I think if he was in any other team, and I'm including kind of like Liverpool and Chelsea in this, he would be one of the stars of the show. But the way that we are with our kind of deep squad and our rotating forward line, he sort of gets rotated in and out of the team a lot. And you know, you kind of don't don't notice him when he's not there sometimes, which is a weird thing to say, but he's kind of like, you know, Sterling and Jesus, he's in that kind of stable of players where they come in and out and they do the bit and then they go out and sit on the bench again. And it wouldn't surprise me if Mahrez was on the bench for the next game and someone else comes in, but that's just the way it is at City, really. But yeah, I think he's a superb player and I'm always happy to see him on the team sheet nowadays.
Yeah, have you noticed that he goes down the outside a little bit more, Howard, this season? It's certainly when he's playing on the right hand side, and we know he loves to check in on his left. There's a number of times this season where I've consciously realised he's gone round the outside on his right, as if it's something that he's been working on.
I'll take your word for it. well, in a way, yeah, because when we've struggled, and it's not just him, when we've struggled against low blocks and teams that don't want to come out and play, and after the Leeds game, you can see why. Then it can be predictable. You think of Robin. Robin, you knew what he was going to do, but you couldn't stop it. He'd always come inside, but he'd whip it into the top corner all the time. But I don't think anyone's on that level of, like, you can still stop it. If you know a player's one-footed and you know what they're going to do, it's obviously so much easier to deal with. So if he is working that into the game, his game, that is absolutely brilliant, because it puts, you know, it leaves defenders unsure of where to commit and, you know, how to defend, basically. And it gives, obviously, City to attack far more options. So, yeah, it's the one who absolutely spoils us fans, but the thing that still surprises me is how one-footed a lot of our players are, and that can lead to predictable football because they can only go one way. So if players are working on, you know, on both feet, basically, and it just gives us even more of an arsenal going forward in future games.
Yeah, there was one moment, though, where City had a corner and Mahrez and Grealish had swapped over because of the setup from the corner, and the ball got cleared. So they're still in that, they're not in that reset position. And I remember Grealish picking the ball up on the right-hand side, and I was thinking, well, go on, you're right-footed on the right-hand side. Let's see what happens now. See if you go around the outside. And he still cut inside, but this time onto his left. And I was like, okay, maybe it's just the one thing he wants to do all the time. He's just cut inside, but here we are. I think it was you. This is, again, testing my memory of what we've done already, you know, just over 15 minutes into the show. And I think it was you, Howard, that said some players got rest during the game. And I suppose it's quite telling, isn't it, that Guardiola took Bernardo off at halftime, Rodri off on 56 minutes and Diaz off on 65 minutes. Three subs before, like on or before 65 minutes, when Guardiola normally doesn't make any till about 70.
Yeah. And if you're going to name, who do you want to come off if it's going well? Then it's those three. But Bernardo had a little niggle, apparently felt a bit of discomfort. So it was, he's 3-0 up at half-time at home to Leeds. You're not going to take any risk with him, are you? You bring him off and it doesn't seem to be anything serious. Got a five-day gap between games. Hopefully he'll be absolutely fine and available for selection. But yeah, I mean, it's just, pick three, and they're the three you take. That's just part of the thing. When it's going well, use your substitutes. You know, it's just like, we've got that fourth. I'm still, obviously, as the nervous City fan, still not totally comfortable until the fourth goal goes in. But it came so early in the second half that Leeds were beating it. In that moment, as soon as Mahrez's goal goes in, Leeds are, the heads are down, they're done, absolutely done. They were probably trying to defend for 3-0 anyway in that second half. But they're done at 4-0, and you could bring on any number of players who could really, you know, pad the stats out in that second half. So it would have been very frustrating if you hadn't done that, to be honest. So it was good to see. Could have brought some youth players on maybe, but hey, can't have everything.
The players in particular, Dan, I mean, Rodri is the one you mentioned before about his performance. I think you kind of knew what game you were going to get the moment that he made two kind of block challenges on his way into setting up Foden's goal, and then one of them was with the goalkeeper. It's like if that's happening from Rodri, you know it's going to be a bit of a balmy match, don't you?
Yeah, the second goal, he was heavily involved in that as well, wasn't he? I just think... I'm just in love with this man at the moment, to be honest with you. I love watching him. You watch him, you know, I was as big a skeptic, Rodri skeptic as anyone in the past couple of seasons. You know, even the back end of last season, he lost his place to Fernandinho and didn't, you know, get a run out in the Champions League final. And you kind of think, what is the point of this guy? But he's come in this season and been absolutely superb. He looks physically bigger and stronger. I don't know if he is, but he certainly exudes that kind of, you know, monstrousness on the pitch at the moment. It's he's receiving the ball in better ways than he has before. I think he's sort of really worked on sort of receiving the ball with the right body shape to move it on and turn quickly, and that's really helping our build up play, and he's getting into positions, he's scoring incredible goals, he's, you know, blocking things on the line, winning tackles, he's doing everything, he's everywhere on the pitch at once, it seems. He's all over the place, and it's in the best possible way, and it's just, yeah, I'm just enjoying watching him so much. And also watching him with a tiny little bit of worry that what do we look like if he can't play at any point, yeah. If he's out for a few games, what does City look like? Is Fernandinho capable of doing his job now? It was the other way around in the past, wasn't it, really? You sort of wonder whether Rodri was good enough to fill Fernandinho's shoes. It's now the other way around. So, yeah, but he's just brilliant. I love him.
I've just checked if monstrousness would be the right word to describe him, because I was just checking to see if it was a word to start with. But it means shockingly hideous or frightful in appearance.
I mean, yeah, to the opposition, yeah, I suppose he is, yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. The other two, Howard, Diaz and Bernardo, have both been important this season. Can we talk a little bit about the attempted lie-down block by Ruben Diaz in the second half? That was just a bit weird, wasn't it?
No, not at all. It's pure defending. It's sadly lacking from the game nowadays. I mean, I saw Liverpool, well, one of those endless Liverpool accounts, put that clip on Twitter as a joke. I mean, just why don't you just admit you've never been near a football ground and been following football for 10 years? He's a pure defender who would do anything in the same way Sean Gerrard would do anything. He would stick his arse towards a ball to get it into the goal. He'll do anything to keep it out of the goal. He's pure defender. It's sadly lacking in the game because it's pretty much impossible to defend properly in a penalty area anymore. They run like they're in River Dance with their hands behind the back because they don't want to give away penalties for handball. You go anywhere near it, try and do a tackle, the player's going to be rolling around. It's just so nice to see someone just throw their body in. Yeah, it might not look aesthetically pleasing, but
he flopped like a dead fish.
He'll fight. Yeah, but he'll fight to get. It's just like, yeah, whatever the score, whatever the situation, he just will do anything. He doesn't care what it looks like to block a ball, and it kind of worked as well. It might not hit him, but you know, it might put the player off enough anyway. So yeah. Yeah, I'm all for it anyway.
I love that that whole sort of passage of play. Actually, it was sort of Leeds' first opening of the game, and to see how quickly City got men back into the 6-yard box to defend that and snuff it out was really, really good. And we've got the best defence in Europe, I think. At the moment, which is something that I never really thought I'd say about a Guardiola team a few years ago. It was never really a priority, was it? But we've got a great defence, incredible defence, and we're scoring 7 goals, and yeah, everything's great at the moment, isn't it?
I mean, that's good because we had conceded, what was it, 4 or 5 games on the row.
Yeah.
We won the games, but it was conceded 5 in a row, so to get 2 clean sheets in the week, is just different. Obviously, Edison would love that, but I think the team love it as well as a whole to keep a clean sheet.
Yeah, Diaz definitely does as well. That's the other thing. While we're on defending in the penalty area, let's turn our attention a little bit to the Wolves game, because Dan, it's a bad performance from the referee, isn't it? When he gives a soft red card to the opposition and a dodgy penalty, and fans still go, "God, he was crap, wasn't he?"
Yeah, he's not a good referee. He never has been. I've never been a fan of his, and his lack of control over this game was really poor. And I think you can come away as a City fan and say that penalty probably shouldn't have been given, and I don't know about the red card. I think that was probably fair enough, to be honest.
I was going to say, Howard, like, I say soft red card, but like, John Moss genuinely didn't have any choice, did he? He'd booked Rodri for a soft foul, you know, a few minutes earlier. So when Jimenez does that back, it's kind of like, well, I've got to give him a yellow card for that. I've set the bar already. And then yeah. Jimenez he's kicked the ball away and got away with that, and then he's not moved back. So like, what choice has he got?
Well, I've discussed it with, yeah, the first one. It doesn't really matter if it's soft or not. Soft yellow cards are given out. you know, you then get on with it, you stay away, you get on with the game. I mean, he's probably frustrated a bit, the Wolves player, because he's, I mean, what was his role in that match? It was literally just like, I don't know, a dog chasing a boomerang in a park. He's just like running around, the ball never came his way, he's frustrated. You get that, but it's like, stupidity is off the scale. The second yellow card is absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. It is. That's the laws of the game. He has to get a second yellow for that. So you should have no sympathy for him. If it was soft, the first one, maybe a bit, then it doesn't really matter. Soft cards are given out and you behave yourself and you stay away from trouble, as thousands of other players do when they're on a yellow. So, and yeah, Moss was just, he'd lost control of the match, but that was one of the few things he got absolutely spot on.
Yeah, in fairness, Dan, I do think I don't think I've seen anything from outside like criticism of Moss for giving the red card. It was all criticism of Jimenez, wasn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. It's just a bit brainless from him, really, wasn't it? But yeah, I don't like how it said. Yeah, you see yellow card, soft yellow cards given all the time. We'd had a couple of soft yellow cards in the game already, and I almost think that the yellow card that Jimenez got was Moss kind of sort of evening it out a little bit, which you see referees do an awful lot, don't you? So once you're on a yellow card, you have to just be really careful. And what to get a second yellow card within what, 48 seconds was it or something?
38.
It's just insane. Yeah.
Yeah, let's finish the first part of the show with the VAR calls because I, in the way that I do, I've gone and found out the reasoning for the penalty calls. Let's start with the penalty that was given. Gian Moutinho, the arm is certainly in an unnatural position. So therefore, the decision for the VAR is not whether or not it's a clear and obvious error. The VAR basically has to find definitive evidence that the ball didn't hit the arm. The deflection off the ribs doesn't matter because of where the arm is. And because the VAR basically couldn't find the image that showed that the ball did not hit Moutinho's arm, it won't overturn the decision that John Moss has given. That being said, Dan, like John Moss probably shouldn't have given the penalty in the first place. And if he hadn't, the VAR wouldn't then have overturned it and said, yes, that's a penalty.
Yeah, I don't think it was a penalty. Yeah, I was getting pretty anxious about this game in the second half and thinking it was going to be one of them where we'd probably draw 0-0 and lament the drop points. So when that penalty was given, I was delighted, obviously. But when you seen the replays back, I was pretty surprised that it wasn't overturned, really. I think VAR has definitely it's definitely improved this season. I don't know whether that is just because they're taking a more sort of lackadaisical approach to it and just letting things go and stuff like that. But yeah, it's. I'm still not sure on this clear and obvious thing. It seems like too loose a definition for me. I feel like with something like that, there should be some sort of intervention, because how could the referee really make a judgment call or something like that?
Yeah, clear and obvious in this position here would be that either the ball hasn't hit his arm, which is what it was looking for, or his arm wasn't in an unnatural position. Well, it was. Mm-hmm. So that's what the error is. And because it's not a clear and obvious error that the ball hasn't hit his arm, they've stuck with the on-field decision.
Yeah, I don't know what the ref's view of it was, and if he had even if he had a good view of it, it might have looked like it had hit Moutinho's arm, but the replay showed that it didn't. So it's like, surely you have to intervene there. It doesn't make any sense to me.
One of those weird games where City definitely deserved a penalty for me during the game. I'm just not sure it was deserved when we actually got it.
Yeah, well, the other one. That Match of the Day highlighted it. Max Kilman in the first half leaning into Jack Grealish's cross, I think it was. The ball hit him around the badge, and just in the Premier League, this has constantly been judged as a fair place for the ball to strike on the level of the arm. And so the fact that he leans into it doesn't matter, because if he hadn't leaned into it, it's still not judged as handball. It's just not been judged as handball this season, and I think that one, weirdly, is a penalty, Howard.
Well, I've seen a still, and it seems a bit lower than that. I thought it was touching near his elbow, so I just don't agree with it. I mean, is it Dale Johnson on Twitter that always gives the VAR update early in the week, and he knows his stuff and appreciates his views, but he can still give an opinion sometimes and say, well, yes, you've explained why, but I don't agree with it. I think it's a bit lower down than they say it was. I don't think it was on the badge. Is the badge like upper arm? Upper? Is it middle of upper arm where the badge is?
It's this mysterious T-shirt line. Yeah,
yeah. It's all ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's like, again, if you're given it, would it have been overturned? I don't know. But there's a third. I think The third one that I can't find a replay for is when Raheem Sterling allegedly poked Saïss in the eye. He was being held back as he went into the penalty area. That's the penalty for me. And of course, he doesn't go down, so you don't get it. And that's why players go down, because once that move's broken down, which it did within 1 or 2 seconds, he should be pointed to the spot. He was as far as I can remember, he was dragging him back in the area, maybe outside as well, but it doesn't appear on the replay, on the match highlights. So, as I say, overall, yeah, it was our first league penalty of the season, I think. Overall, I think there's a penalty in there somewhere, but that's probably not how the game should be run. So.
Yeah, the thing that annoyed me about the post-match discourse was all this. I mean, obviously Liverpool and Chelsea both got penalties on the same day, and it was all, yes, it's the referee favouring the big clubs again. And it's like, when was the last time we got a dodgy penalty? Like, it hardly ever happens to City, does it?
No.
It's, like you said, first league penalty of the season.
Yeah,
it's not, the big, it's not something that happens big, every week, is it?
No, the big clubs and United all won with a penalty in the weekend. So. I think that it just felt like everyone scraped through that weekend with a win without perhaps, getting a bit of luck on the way. But there's no conspiracy there.
Yeah.
Well, not for City anyway.
Not for City anyway, yeah. We'll leave everybody else to make the judgments elsewhere. Let's move on. On Tuesday evening, the UK government voted through its Plan B for coronavirus measures. As it stands, football will still go ahead with crowds, but supporters will need to show COVID passes to gain entry into stadiums, and face masks need to be worn in indoor settings. We've just completed a season that was played mostly behind closed doors, and it might have changed the way that City played as well. We hear all the time that the fans can beat the 12th man, but in City's case, can that encouragement actually cause a problem sometimes? We've put Sam Roscoe on the case.
Last February on the podcast, City fan Dan Burke said this.
It's a combination of really good pressing and really good possession play. Like, maybe in the past, I think the possession has been decent, but the pressing's been off, or vice versa. But I think they're just operating on a really high level in all departments at the moment. And I think the off-the-ball movement is probably as good as it's ever been under Guardiola, and the opposition just can't get near us at times.
He was describing how City had transformed their style of play at the beginning of the 2021 calendar year. In the first half of last season, City hadn't been dominating games, but by the time Dan was speaking on this particular episode of the podcast, Pep Guardiola had just led the team to 19 wins in a row.
I think the empty stadiums have been beneficial to City. City don't have to worry about external influences like a hostile crowd when they go away from home now. The games are being played under kind of laboratory conditions, and I think it suits City because all they have to worry about now is going on the pitch and being the better football team, and almost all the time they will be better than whoever they come up against.
That could be one reason why City were so good last year. The emotion of the fans wasn't a factor, and the players could concentrate on what they were being coached to do. But maybe it only suited City because they were in form. Here's Liverpool fan Neil Atkinson talking about the impact of behind-closed-doors games ahead of City's 4-1 win at Anfield that season.
What we've struggled with this season is sides committing to a certain shape, getting encouragement because Liverpool aren't playing that well, and absolutely still sticking with that shape. So a really good example is the Newcastle away game. And under a normal circumstance, there are 50,000 drunken maniacs in St James's Park. And when it's 0-0 with 20 to go, no matter how good your shape work's been for the previous 70 minutes, the crowd are saying, go and score one, go and score one. And Newcastle just stick with the shape because there's no crowd in. Games becoming emotional and getting carried away from footballers isn't happening.
Put simply, players make better decisions when there's no emotional pressure from their own fans when they're at home, and no hostile pressure from opposition fans in away games. Perhaps this week has been evidence of that with City.
We won with fans or we won without fans. And without fans is exception. We play all our lives, being teenagers, being in academy, being in the professional world with fans. So it's not absolutely a problem. And I think the players give the enough adrenaline and enough energy. You play with our fans or against them to do what you have to do.
That was Guardiola speaking before the 1-0 win over Wolves on Saturday, when we asked him if it was harder for his players to make good decisions now that the fans were back in grounds. But then after the match, he gave a slightly different answer.
We lost simple balls, 4 or 5 simple balls, that is not necessary. and we break in this situation because we play at home, because demanding the people, and when that happens, you lose the balls, easy balls, and after the counter-attack, we didn't defend well the throw-ins, we didn't defend well the high positions, like we have one more man, we drop too much to defend the result, it is completely the opposite.
The manager was actually asked how important Edison's save from Max Kilman was in the final few minutes, but instead of talking about that, he gave an interesting insight into how protecting a narrow lead in front of your own fans can be difficult, because the supporters want to see the goal that kills the game.
We were really good with 11, he could not run, they didn't do one shoot on target with 11 at the end, because we didn't press good, we drop, but we play with emotion, you know, it's last minute, 1-0, the game is over. And that's happened, but we create enough chances and clear ones to score more goals.
City have started the season very well, but they've still had some minor issues when it comes to how to play against some teams at the Etihad.
In this type of games, like the team comes to defend, expect the episodic action, you cannot do mistakes. We did it in Crystal Palace, in Southampton we were not good, we played not good, and that's why it happened. But at Crystal Palace we did enough mistakes that to put me, they are waiting for that.
Last term might have started slowly because City were getting used to playing in the pandemic. So maybe those performances against teams like Southampton and Crystal Palace could be down to the players getting used to having a home crowd once again. It's probably not a major issue. Just a few minutes ago, we played a clip of Guardiola where he said that City have won titles with and without fans. And as he always says, City will adapt to whatever the situation is. After all, this season's been going all right so far.
Hi, I'm Paul Walsh and you're listening to the Blue Moon podcast.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Please support the show by becoming a backer. patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Sam Roscoe looking at the influence of the fans inside the Etihad. Just before we move on, obviously, Dan, the situation with Omicron is changing constantly in the UK at the moment. You're in Germany right now. So, I mean, games there have been going behind closed doors, have they? Is it a national thing or is it still regional?
Still regional, yeah. Some of them have been completely behind closed doors. Some of them have just had a sort of percentage of fans. The Bayern Munich Borussia Dortmund game a few weeks ago, there was 15,000 fans there. So, yeah, they've been pretty strict about the measures here. Most of life is kind of going on as normal. And they've actually closed the nightclubs now, or you're not allowed to go to a night. You can go to a nightclub, but you're not allowed to dance in the nightclub. You can still go to a bar and restaurant, but you can. So
you can go to a bar and restaurant, but you can't eat or drink.
No, you can't eat or drink, thankfully. Yeah. But just no dancing. You've got to remain seated at all time, which makes me think they should like open a nightclub where everyone's on like office chairs, you know, where you can just roll around. That'd be the solution to me. But yeah, in terms of the football, it's taken a bit of a, but they've got the winter break coming up here as well now. So right.
Things shut down anyway. Howard, are you nervous that it's a busy schedule for teams in England over the Christmas period? Are you nervous that we might go behind closed doors for a bit?
Yeah, I think the new issue here is that it's players testing positive, not the general population. It's not just, let's look at the figures nationally. If players are testing positive, then you can't play games behind closed doors. You just have no football. And it does feel, I'm afraid, that that's where we're heading for. Now, there's a winter break here at the end of January, so it's a long way away.
Yeah.
Perhaps move it. Perhaps we have a summer without a major competition. Well, without the World Cup. We do have some leeway there. It does feel that we are heading towards more and more cancellations. It's just inevitable in a way. The safety of players and obviously fans are both equally important. And when it gets to the point that that safety cannot be guaranteed, then unfortunately there's nothing else to do. But we talked about this originally in Project Restart and all that. We've got, time is just whatever you want it to be. If it needs to stop for a couple of weeks, then stop for a couple of weeks and then carry on after that. But I guess time will tell. But there's going to be, at the very least, there's going to be a lot of individual games called off in the next couple of weeks across the leagues. That's just now inevitable.
Yeah, well, at time of recording, City's game against Newcastle is going ahead on Sunday. Dan, it's amazing what a 7-0 win can do for your confidence, isn't it?
I mean, I don't want to be too confident going into this game, but I do think we are, coming up against the worst team in the league as well. So it does seem like a case of easy pickings, doesn't it, really, which is the famous last words, I guess. But it's hard to see past the win, really.
Just looking at the schedule as well, Howard, we're talking about players, getting players in form and getting players rest. Who do you think needs to be on the pitch at any point in this game, and who needs to just kind of like have their minutes managed right now?
I honestly don't think it matters. I think Torres is out and Walker was not fully fit, apparently, for the game against Leeds. Otherwise, you've got a 5-day gap from the Leeds game, which, let's be honest, I still think City were probably third gear in that second half, and we took 3 players off. Unless I'm wrong, do correct me, there's no match for a week after the Newcastle game, is there not?
It's League Cup week, isn't it? So I think the City are out,
exactly.
So there's no game.
So essentially, he can just pick the team he wants to pick for me. I don't see... I mean, Kevin De Bruyne, perhaps you keep playing him now because he's come back in, he's put in that performance. Phil Foden's come in, excellent. I don't know the stats behind him. Maybe they need still to keep building match fitness and rhythm and stuff like that. But essentially, pick whoever you want. Whoever's available. We've actually not got to play midweek. And if they're showing... If you pick from your pool of players who are showing total 100% fitness.
Yeah. I mean, this is the interesting thing, Dan. We always talk when City have these games, don't they, where outsiders always say, you see the strength in depth that City have got. They've named a team there that's strong enough to win this game. And then you look at the team, and it is a team that's strong enough to win this game, but it's like the team that faced Leeds at the Etihad last season, where it's just basically all the players that aren't going to play. And it's not a cohesive system. So there is an element of balance here, isn't there? When you rest in players, that when you rotate players, it needs to be kind of not too much.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, and there's also the aspect of trying to keep everyone's rhythm going as well, which is, I think, was the case with the Leipzig game the other week. A lot of people were surprised, first of all, with the team selection and the subs that, we didn't really bring any youngsters on, and a lot of people were a bit disappointed with that. But I think a lot of times people kind of see Guardiola as this kind of like mad professor who just kind of does things on a whim and does what he wants. But there's a whole sports science department behind him who are sort of instructing him in these decisions. And I think
don't do this.
I think it seems to be the case this season that they are trying to keep everyone's rhythm and give everyone a certain amount of minutes and keep that ticking over. So I think there will be changes for this Newcastle game, but I don't think they're going to be wholesale changes. I mean, I'd like to think Kyle Walker will come back in and João Cancelo. You would imagine that Raheem Sterling will get a run out, Gabriel Jesus as well. I don't know who drops out for
that's
them.
That's 4 changes right there, though. That's the thing.
Yeah, yes. But, I mean, that's pretty normal, isn't it? It's pretty normal that we might make 4 or 5 changes per game, really. So, yeah, I don't think he's going to go too mad. I don't think we're going to see any young players in this game, really, or certainly from the start. But, yeah.
Let's make you feel a little bit more nervous, Howard, because Newcastle, not a great team, but Guardiola's record there, it looks all right because it's played 5-1-3-1. But one of those wins was that 4-3 nonsense last season after they'd already won the title. And another win was a very, very nervy 1-0.
Yeah, there's a 2-all in there as well, Ben.
Yeah, that was that's the single.
Talking about Kevin De Bruyne, yeah, super strikes. I remember watching somewhere abroad that ruined my weekend. It's straight, I still remember, the 2-1 defeat that I thought had cost us the title. It's a strange one. But as I say, if City go out like they do, I can't see Newcastle playing dead and just stacking their penalty area. And it's a very strange situation for Newcastle, in that the team isn't very good. So if City turn up, they should absolutely, just put 3 or 4 past them easily. I don't see any other outcome. And to be honest, it doesn't really matter what happened 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But even though Newcastle in a very difficult position here, being the richest club in the world, but might well get relegated, the fans are obviously reinvigorated because of the new ownership. And there will be a great atmosphere there. I don't think that really matters to City players. I think they'll...
Wow, it's interesting,
Well, they've played, they've been there and done it. And of course, it's an advantage. I look at Liverpool, by the time people listen to this, Liverpool will probably put 10 past Newcastle on the Thursday night game if it goes ahead. And I see that as being an absolute thrashing. It's obviously harder for City going to Newcastle, being the away team, I think, playing them at home. But the fact is, our away form this season has been as good as our performances, definitely has been as good as our home performances, I think. Some of our most troublesome games have been like Crystal Palace, the Southampton draw, even like 2-0 win over Burnley and Wolves. If City are focused and on form, they win that game easily. But Newcastle will fight. I don't think we'll just go out there and put another 7 past the team.
Yeah.
But I think eventually the class has to tell in that game.
I just wonder, Dan, we heard Sam a few minutes ago on the different pressures faced by created by having fans in the stadium. I just wonder how much fans in St. James's Park actually help City. Because, in that sense that fans in the Etihad don't maybe help City, in that the fans are frustrated because what's happening on the pitch is not what they want to see, but it is what Guardiola wants to see. That kind of disassociation with kind of expectations. And then you look at St. James's Park, the fans at St. James's Park are going to be going to Newcastle. Get amongst them, get at them. And all that does is encourage them to break the shape and allow City to play through them.
Yeah, they've a team with a sort of lack of identity at the moment as well, aren't they? Eddie Howe's taken over. He's trying to play this new style of football with a bunch of players who aren't really adapting to it at the moment and who don't know what the futures look like. So it's a very messy club at the moment, really. And it seems like something that we could take advantage of. I mean, you looked at the game, the first game for them post takeover when they played Tottenham, and the atmosphere was incredible, and they were sort of 1-0 down after a few minutes and ended up losing. And it was... I feel like that sort of buzz has kind of fizzled out a little bit for them now, and maybe it'll be different in a pre-Christmas game with all their fans have been on the Newcastle Brown Ale all afternoon, and they might be up for it. They might bring the noise, but I feel like City are just good enough to kind of cut through that at the moment, and we're not really letting that affect us at all, which is very encouraging.
I do wonder what changes they'll make, because if they've had to play on a Thursday night, we played on Tuesday night, then just puts them at a bigger disadvantage.
So. And they'll have played Liverpool away, which is, hopefully Liverpool will just butter them up for us, really.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, it might not be that deep. They might just roll over and die at Anfield because they're going, well, there's nothing we're going to get out of this one. Yeah, there we go. Just a final question on this game, Howard. Are you ready for the off-the-pitch narrative this week? And how do you plan to deal with it?
Oh, do you mean the ownership?
Yeah, it's the ownership.
Oh, I hadn't even thought of that.
The ownership derby, isn't it?
No, I don't. I'm past caring. I hadn't even thought about that. Oh, God, what new name are they going to come up with for this one?
I haven't got one.
To be honest, I'm past caring. I don't read previews of matches because there's nothing to learn anymore, is it? I know the situation. I know what's involved. I'll keep well away from the internet perhaps over the weekend and just focus on the match itself. So.
You liar. There's no way you're staying away from Twitter. There is no way.
Well, I'll put my booster jab in as well, so that'll keep you away for an hour or so.
Yeah. Right. Well, to get a Newcastle view on this weekend's match, I've been speaking to Alex Hurst, who is the host of the Newcastle podcast True Faith. I started by asking what life was like in the post-Mike Ashley era.
Life's much better, despite the perilous league position. You know, we always wondered as fans how many people Ashley had forced away from the club. In terms of match-going fans, and that figure seems to be about 20,000. You know, the stadium is full. You can't get a ticket for games anymore. It's kind of how it used to be pre-Mike Ashley. So despite the problems on the pitch, fans have re-engaged, which is brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, how's form lately? We're talking ahead of your game with Liverpool. So, I mean, how's form been lately under Eddie Howe? I mean, I saw that you got your first win of the season against Burnley. But have performances changed?
Performances have been miles better. Sadly, results haven't followed. You know, Howe's taken 5 points from his first 5 games, which is an improvement because the team were on about half a point a game before he came in. But I think performances should have led to about 8 or 9 points from those 5 games. So while that's incredibly promising performance-wise, we really need the points.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of players that have stepped up, what's changed? Is there anybody who's had a new lease of life under Eddie Howe?
Yeah, definitely. Jonjo Shelvey's a player that many Newcastle fans would not have thought would have risen back to being a key part of the team under Howe, but he really is a changed player. He looks revitalised. He's now an integral selection. And yeah, he's been absolutely brilliant. You know, players like Miguel Almiron and, you know, players who were a little bit marginalised under Bruce all seem to have found a new lease of life, which is great because they are good players. They are our best players. So Howe's done a really good job of reintegrating those guys very quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, I saw as well most recent goals, Callum Wilson. How's he doing?
Brilliant. He's got that pre-existing relationship with Howe, which seems to have worked really well as well. He's a complete leader. I mean, if we were to lose him, it's not that far until January now, but I think he's the one player in the whole squad who's completely irreplaceable for Newcastle.
Yeah, and I mean, you mentioned before about the fans being back in St James's in the numbers. Obviously, it's been a bit of a weird time, I guess, because everything was behind closed doors, and then it was kind of opening up again. And that, like you say, now there's a full house every week. How important has that been for the team?
Oh, massive! That home game against Burnley was one of my favourite games of all time. The support was just out of this world. You know, it was 18th playing 19th in the division, and the atmosphere. You know, people will talk about that game for years to come because everyone in the whole stadium, from a Newcastle's perspective, was so behind the players. It was the same against Norwich when we went down to 10 men after 8 minutes. It's like the crowd sucked the team through to get a point. Should have really won the game, in fact, against 10 men. So that's just as a football fan, you know, like you say, we have had that little spell of being away. But when we came back at the start of the season, it was just rubbish again because it was Bruce and it was Ashley. It was almost like you hadn't been away in terms of things being as bad as they were. People, you know, the crowd, the ground not being full, the stadium being quiet, people getting on the players' backs and the manager's back. This is a totally different scenario, much more enjoyable as a supporter.
Yeah, what's the hope for the season now? I mean, obviously, as we speak in 19th place, but the outside of the relegation zone, it looks very much within touching distance, does it?
Yeah, the hope for the season is 17th place. It's funny, actually, because all Mike Ashley ever wanted was to finish 17th, and now we really need to. We can realise his dream. But yeah, it's going to be really hard to step. Newcastle will have to make history as the first team not to win any of their first 14 Premier League games to stay up in a 38-game season. So it's a massive ask. And you know, the next three fixtures, Liverpool, Manchester City, Man United, then two tough away games back-to-back in Everton and Southampton. I mean, you know, there's five fixtures there before January and the transfer window opens. We've got to stay 4, 5, 6 points from 17th and hope to go again in January.
I mean, it's funny as well that you look at a team like City coming to town. I mean, first off, what are your expectations for that game? How do you think Newcastle will play?
The expectation is that we are hard to beat at home. Our home record is not too bad this season for a team in our position. And, you know, I'd really like to think Newcastle could maybe take a point. Obviously, Manchester City in fantastic form after, well, not just the Leeds game, before the Leeds game too, but the Leeds game in particular shows you what can happen if Man City are on a good day and you're a little bit off it, like Leeds might have been. So it'll be a really hard game, but I'm still really looking forward to it. At home, I always give us a chance against anyone at St James's Park. It's away from home that we do most of our terrible work. So I'm still looking forward to the game.
Yeah, and I mean, we have to talk a little bit, I guess, about the ownership, because there's been a lot of criticism towards Newcastle with the new owners, and there's been a similar sort of criticism towards City in the past about the social issues that fans face with having owners from a country like Saudi Arabia and a place like Abu Dhabi for City. How do you kind of compartmentalize it all at the moment?
I've done a lot of media about this, and I say the same thing to everyone. You know what, if there needs to be rules in English football about who owns football clubs and them being either not from autocratic states or not from anyone who would deem to be bad for the English game, whatever that might mean, do it. These people, just do it. You don't need me or you or any other City or Newcastle fan to legislate English football. Like, we're very much not considered when people at the top make these decisions about how English football works. So if football needs governance and restructuring, great, you know, crack on and do it. But don't come to me or another football fan and say, why are you letting this happen? Because we're not letting this happen. This happens to us. The Premier League don't like governance. They don't like the fan-led review. They don't like outside interference. Fine, that's okay. That is how it is. But what do you want ordinary football fans to do about this? We don't have a say in it. We don't get asked. Should football fans be asked about when the football club has taken over? I think so. But the people with the power in the game, right up, you know, not just the decision makers, but people in the media, people who make a lot of money out of football, they're quite happy with the way football works at the minute. So I don't quite understand why it therefore falls on football fans, who are given the least say of all, to be the ones who have to speak out about this. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, and shoulder the responsibility as well. It's an unfair burden at times. In a similar sort of vein, when you look across at City and the takeover in 2008, where do you kind of hope Newcastle can go from here in terms of the resources that the club now has, assuming that you can stay in the league this season?
Yeah, I would love, obviously, to replicate what City did. I think that might be hard for a number of factors. Football's changed since 2008, and financial fair play is now a much bigger thing, and there's all sorts of barriers. Not least that City have shown how to do it, and other clubs will be more mindful of that as well, and trying to prevent a similar kind of thing happening to, you know, to the elite of the game being breached like that. You know, Amanda Staveley said on day one she wants to win the Premier League in the next 5 to 10 years. That's their ambition. They also want to make Newcastle one of the 5 biggest football clubs in the world. I'm fully behind that, of course. Whether they can do it is a different question. Staying up this season is the first part. But you know what? If Newcastle can be a team that competes every single season in the top 10 of the Premier League with aspirations of the top 6, that will be enough for me.
Yeah. Just final question then. We have a charity bet coming up a bit later on in the show. What's your score prediction for this? I'll let you take my bet.
I'll go 2-2.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
That was Alex Hurst from True Faith. Now, surprisingly, none of last week's panel saw a 7-0 thumping of Leeds coming, so we're still on £930 for the charity bet this season. William Hill has given each of us a £10 correct score single, and the winnings are going to the Man City Fans Food Bank. They're collecting donations of food and money for Manchester Central Food Bank, which helps people living in poverty in the city. We heard from Alex that he's gone with an optimistic 2-2 draw. That's 28-1 and £280 if he's right on that. We'll start with you, Howard. What's your score prediction for this game?
A confident 3-0.
A confident 3-0 is 6-1 and £60 if you're right. Dan?
An even more confident 4-0.
An even more confident 4-0 is 9-1 and £90 if you're right. You've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. Please gamble responsibly. And for more, visit begambleaware.org. Now, to finish the show this week, I just wanted to reflect on this.
Bueno, A esta conferencia es,
this conference
para comunicarle que
is to communicate
con el, he decidido
that I have decided
de jugar al, al fútbol.
To stop playing football.
That was from Sergio Aguero's news conference on Wednesday morning as he announced that due to his health and recently diagnosed heart arrhythmia, he's retiring from football. Weirdly, it's quite nice that City play Newcastle this weekend because he scored more goals for City against Newcastle than any other team. It was 15 in 15. Dan, I watched this live, this news conference, and the second he took to the stage in tears, it absolutely broke me. Were you watching along at the same time?
I was, yeah. I was covering it live at work, so I had to keep it together a little bit. But I shed a tear myself. I'm not going to lie. My girlfriend was sat next to me, crying her eyes out as well. It was heartbreaking, wasn't it? Obviously, the news had been kind of trailed the day before that he was going to make this announcement. It wasn't confirmed what that announcement would be, but I think everybody read between the lines. And I don't know. There was a small part of me that kind of thought maybe he's not going to retire. Maybe he's just going to come out and say, "Oh yeah, we're still going to, you know, keep trying and see what happens." But when they showed him, you know, the stage set up at Camp Nou, and there was all the players from Barcelona there, and you know, other people like Guardiola and Cheeky there, you knew what it was going to be, didn't you? And as soon as he comes on, he's in tears already. Then yeah, it was awful to watch. But yeah, what a tragic end to his career it is, really.
Yeah, Howard, I was going to say it's a sad end to, like, it's a great player who doesn't deserve to have his career ended like that, does he?
I mean, sadly, you just don't get fairy tales in football all the time. You don't get to write the script. He was so good at such an early age. Be thankful that he still had a good 15 years of absolute world-class football in him and a fair length career. But he had more to give, and it's sad. But I was sad because he's the happiest footballer I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
And to see him crying is just horrible. But I'm relieved as well, because at the end of the day, he's had a damn good career, and his health's more important. And I'm kind of relieved that he has made the decision to look after his health over playing a bit more football for a year or two. So yeah. It's more visually that, you knew what the press conference was about. And he's got his, you know, full life ahead of him, and yeah, hope he finds a new passion that makes him really happy.
Yeah, I feel a little bit sad, Dan, that it didn't end at City in a way, because it feels like the Barcelona era Aguero is just kind of tacked on, and it doesn't, like, it's not the same player and in the, not the same vein. You look at, it's like a lot of those veteran players that City signed in the noughties, where you're thinking, yeah, like, your career does not deserve to go out with a year at City. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. There was a video that Barcelona posted on their social media yesterday, where after the press conference, they'd sort of got him to say a little piece to camera, and his eyes are still bloodshot from crying, and he sort of said, "Oh, thank you, Barcelona. I'll always cheer for you," and this kind of thing. And I felt like he's not really your legend. He's our legend, you know what I mean? He's our boy, really. His career with them, you know, got off to a bad start with the fact that he was going there to join up with Messi, and Messi left suddenly, and that was a bit of a blow for him, really. You know, he had injury problems. He came back from that and scored a consolation goal against Real Madrid. And I think he made 5 appearances in total. At the time that we'd decided not to extend his contract, I was gutted about it, obviously, but I was a bit philosophical about it as well. I was thinking, well, you know, he's sort of come to the end of the road. It feels like maybe the right time for both parties to move on. And at the time, we were still, you know, hoping to win the Champions League, and I thought that would have been a great way for him to go out to win the Champions League. That was something that he said, that he wasn't going to leave City until he won it, and for us to lose that game in that manner, and for him to be crying on the pitch at the end was pretty awful way to end it, really. The Everton game was quite nice that he broke that record, but the actual ending was quite sad, really. So yeah, for him to, like, go to Barcelona and then not get his dream of finishing his career at Independiente as well, it's just a real shame. He just, he doesn't deserve that. You don't you often do get what you deserve in football, and he hasn't got what he deserved, I don't think.
Yeah, and it's Howard, you said before there's no fairy tales, and it just kind of that Champions League final shows it, doesn't it? Because like it's the one thing in his career where that he hasn't won, and you're thinking like that it's the if there's any player that deserves to have won it that hasn't won it, it's probably him, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, there's a lot of some of our greatest players haven't won some of the biggest trophies available to them, and that's the nature of a team game in a way. Yeah. You know, he's not. If he was a tennis player, he was one of the best tennis players ever, he'd have the trophies from, you know, he'd have a Grand Slam or something like that. But it's a team game, and that's the way it goes. And there's fine lines, and there's other brilliant teams. And yeah, I wanted to win the Champions League for me more than anything. But I really, really would have been so sweet if it could have been done. Yeah.
Yeah.
With him, and if even so in his final season, even more so. But even better if he'd done it earlier in his City career and been the star on the pitch. So, because he would have been a bit of an observer if we'd won it last season. So, yeah, it's bittersweet in a way, but I don't think he'd have any regrets after such a stellar career.
Yeah, there's a petition, Dan, to rename the North Stand after him. Are you on board with that?
Yeah, great, great idea that, I think. I mean, obviously he's going to get his statue as well, but I think that'd be such a fitting tribute to him scoring the biggest goal that will probably ever be scored at that end of the ground. It doesn't have a name, so why not rename it to something else? And I'm sure it would prompt the usual shite about, your legends all played in the last few years or whatever. What history have you got, kind of thing? And I just think, well, I kind of like that, actually. I kind of like that we've lived through the best period in our history, and we're still living through it, and we're commemorating these players in this way. I think it's really good for us. So I would definitely do that. Yeah,
a bit next to the Colin Bell stand. So recent. He's not that recent. Yeah.
But Howard, I assume you're on board as well, are you?
Not necessarily.
Oh, right, fair enough.
Yeah, I'm not against it. Obviously, I'm just like. The only thing is, there's arguments to be made for so many players in the last decade. He's in the top two anyway. So I just find it so hard to pick one player. But he's had the career of others, and he's got that moment as well, which saved my life, changed my life, and all our lives. So I'm absolutely fine with it, but it's hard in a way when we have created so many legends in such a short space of time that you could rename all of the stands twice over.
Yeah, yeah. Now, just to finish, beyond the obvious, this.
It's finished at Sunderland. Manchester United have done all they can. That Rooney goal was enough for the 3 points. Manchester City are still alive here. Balotelli, Aguero!
So yeah, beyond that, what are your favourite Aguero kind of memories and moments? Dan, I'll start with you.
For me, it's probably his debut against Swansea, because I remember when we signed him, I knew that we were signing a high calibre player. I knew a little bit about him. I'd seen a little bit of him, but not a great deal. It's not like nowadays where everyone knows the ins and outs of every player from here to Timbuktu. It was like, we'd signed this guy, and there was still a little bit of mystique about him, and he comes off the bench in that game and just has an absolute stormer, capped off by that goal at the end. And it was like we'd put a player on the pitch in FIFA or something, and sort of like put all the stats up to 99. Was like we'd got this like incredible like computer game player. And I remember coming home in the car after the game and looking on Twitter. And this, again, Twitter was kind of in its infancy a little bit at the time. And I remember just that all the tweets were about Aguero. It was like Monday Night Football, wasn't it? And all the tweets were like, wow, from other fans and stuff, this guy's amazing. And that was the first time I remember that really being the case, that everyone had been kind of unified in saying something about one player. And, you just knew that we'd got a special player on our hands. You knew that we were going to have a great relationship with him from the moment he stepped on the pitch, really. And everything that came afterwards was just building on that brilliance.
Yeah. Howard, anything else that stands out for you?
Yeah, he's nicked my answer. So I've just never seen anything like that. Yeah, just I knew when he signed, as Dan said, it's like, I think it was the first time I knew we'd signed a superstar. I knew David Silva. Yeah, look at all the other big signs. David Silva, I thought, oh, he looks good. But it took a while to realise just how good. Yaya Toure, I thought, was like defensive-ish midfielder because he had played a bit there for Barcelona. And it took time to realise just what absolute superstars we'd signed. But I knew with Aguero, oh, we've just signed one of the most exciting forward players in the world. And that debut was still blew me away. It was like, oh, my God. But I mean, the thing with Aguero, he's spread it out. He scored heavy goals. He scores against top six sides. It's the genie. You know, he just kept going all the way. So there's too much in a way. There's little individual goals that weren't that important in the scheme of things, but still amazing. That really wide goal against Liverpool. Just when you look at the map of where he scored his goals for City, it's just that one little dot right on the right touchline.
Yeah.
And the five goals against Newcastle in 20 minutes, the hat-trick against Bayern Munich stands out for me as an absolute astonishing match. Yeah.
And there's so much that we haven't mentioned that you forget as well, that you'll sit, that we'll finish the record and you'll go, oh God, I didn't mention this just because of what he scored. I want to finish with the kind of off the pitch stuff as well, because like he really endeared himself to the fans by it's little things like sticking up for the fans when they were spilling onto the pitch at Bournemouth and the treatment from the stewards and the police there, and he was getting involved and kind of backing the fans there. Even like he did an interview with I can't remember who it was with, but he was asked ahead of a Manchester derby, which United player would you take at City if you had to take one, and his answer was, well, if I'm being honest, none of them. And it's just like things like that. It just meant that like the fans loved him for kind of the off the pitch stuff as well as the on the pitch stuff. Howard, you're gonna add something else as well.
Was that? No, all I was going to say is, to be honest, he didn't have to say anything, did he? He just had to smile, and the annoyingly handsome bastard that he is, he probably win over the United fan base as well. So, no, he was just sounds ridiculous to say it, really, but, you know, the grumpy old man that I am, but he was just, he just seemed a genuine, beautiful human being as well.
Yeah.
Just very little. Apart, I think only David Luiz would have on the planet would have a problem with him. For the rest, he was just a wholesome person and just an astonishing footballer and force of nature. Yeah.
That's probably the perfect place to end it. So that brings us to the end of this week's Blue Moon podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for today's show, Dan Burke.
Thank you.
And Howard Hawking.
Absolute pleasure.
If you've enjoyed the show, please give it a rating and a review in all the usual places, but especially on Apple Podcasts if you can. If you'd like to get some extra shows, or you'd like to listen ad-free, then you can sign up to our Patreon page. That's just £2 a month, and you'll get a bonus podcast each Monday as well. This coming Monday, we've got another edition of City Heaven, City Hell, focusing on games with Crystal Palace. City fan Ali Falk has picked his Heaven and Hell games, and so has Palace fan Andre Vincent. Check that out at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast on Monday. We'll be back next week with the final show before Christmas, previewing the matches with Leicester and Brentford, assuming that they go ahead. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please support the show. patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.